Good morning, church. Our reading this morning is taken from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 23, and we're going to read from verses 18 to 49. Hear the word of God. But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again. But they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found him no grounds in him for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant the demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. As the soldiers led him away, they seized Simon from Cyrene, who was on his way in from the country, and put the cross on him and made it carry it behind Jesus. A large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. Jesus turned and said to them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children, for the time will come when you will say, 'Blessed are the childless women, the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if people do these things when the tree is green, what will happen when it is dry?" Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is God, the Messiah, the Chosen One." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God?" he said. "Since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly for what we are getting, what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." When he had said this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, "Surely this was a righteous man." When all the people had gathered to witness this sight, saw what took place, they beat their breasts and went away. But all those who knew him, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance, watching these things. Amen. May God add his blessing to this reading from his word.
Morning, everybody. Morning. This morning we're thinking about this big topic of certain hope that we can have in uncertain times. And I wonder for you, what are those moments in your life that have brought that feeling of uncertainty so much closer? Maybe over the last few weeks, it's just been looking at the petrol prices and seeing them tick over that $3 mark and realizing actually this could impact my life, or seeing some fuel stations that don't have any fuel and wondering, actually, how is that going to mean I'm going to get to work if this continues going like this? Or maybe it's looking a little bit further back and seeing the reason that that's come about and seeing the news and looking at missiles that have been launched and missiles returned and just feeling that sense of uncertainty there. Or maybe it was when you received the power bill and it was $1,000 more than it was this time last year, and just wondering how are we actually going to pay that? Maybe going back further a little bit to that time that we all experienced of mandatory lockdown, where we're stuck at home and you're just wondering what life is going to look like from this point on, this global scale pandemic. Or even looking back before that, when house prices were 60 to 80% less than they are now. And now to buy a house seems like an absolutely impossible achievement. Well, maybe even back further than that, for us, 12 years ago, the opposite was true. We were trying to sell a house, but the market was just not there. Nobody wanted it. And so we're left with a house that nobody could buy and nobody was renting. And for months, that's just sitting in the back pocket, burning away. These moments of uncertainty and these moments that cause uncertainty to just feel like they're so much closer and so much more real. If we go back further than that into what we just read today, we see some uncertain times as well. Here, this episode takes place at a time where the night before what we just read, there's been an angry mob on the streets, an angry mob that's been stomping around all through the night. And now we're introduced to them right at the start of this chapter. We're told that there was this whole gang of them that had arisen and had brought this person, Jesus, before Pilate, the Roman governor. Here they are, this organized group staging an unlawful farce of a trial to crush one man. It's not the kind of night that you want to be out on the streets. It's a moment of uncertainty. But this whole episode, this whole scene that we see with Jesus actually occurs during a time of political, social mess in around 30 to 35 AD when all this is happening. And the context is Roman rule. Here's this vast, imposing superpower that's crushing over the top of all of the people here in Jerusalem. It's referenced quite a few times as we listened along to it being read in this chapter. We see Rome talked about. We've got tributes that they're meant to give to Caesar, we're told about. It's one of these accusations that they throw at Jesus to say that he said, you know, he's stirring up the people to stop paying tributes to Caesar. Here they're living with this crushing tax that they have to give all the time to the Roman Empire that's ruling over the top of them. Or reference to Pilate. Here's a guy who's actually a Roman ruler. He's the governor over Jerusalem at this time. And there is some kind of jurisdiction that this other person is mentioned, Herod. He's a Jewish king, but he's just a puppet for the Roman Empire. And his jurisdiction can be given or taken away at a moment's notice. And we see also that life is really unstable. There's a guy who's been put in prison for insurrection or murder or kind of rebellion and murder on the streets. And we're told later on in verse 24 that Pilate actually lets this guy back out on the streets. Uncertain kind of times. And human life in Jerusalem hangs in the hands of this Roman governor, Pilate. Hands that have made actually a number of political blunders in the past. Not long before, there's been a mass protest in Jerusalem because this governor, Pilate, had put up images of the Roman emperor in Jerusalem, and it caused quite an upset. And before that, he took some money from the Jewish temple, just marched in there and took the money, and then killed the people who protested about it. And another time, he saw this large group of people coming in from Galilee, this different region, coming into Jerusalem to offer sacrifices peaceably at the temple and do their religious ceremonies. And he thought it was a riot, so he killed them all. And then again, he put up more images of the emperor in Jerusalem. And so even other Roman politicians are looking in at Pilate and writing to the emperor about all the unrest that this guy has caused in Jerusalem. They're uncertain times. And now this one man's life hangs in the hands of this person, Pilate. Jesus stands in the hands of Pilate. And we follow the story as it goes through the chapter. Here he is brought before this governor, and what's going to happen? That he's told that this Jesus is claiming to be a king. And he says, well, are you the king of the Jews? And we see Jesus just reply, yeah, you have said so. And Pilate questions him more, but ultimately he can't find any real guilt in this man at all, he's told. But the people won't have that. They want Pilate to do something about this guy. They want him to be crushed. And so they push him further. Pilate realizes that he can maybe palm this off to that other guy that I mentioned, Herod, this puppet king. And so he sends him over to Herod to maybe let Herod sort it all out. And so we see that event unfold in verse 6 through to verse 16. And ultimately, Herod just goes, actually, I'm not going to do anything about this guy Jesus apart from tease him and mock him and beat him and send him back. And so Pilate has the question again, what am I going to do with this guy? He's brought before the people and they cry out for him to do something about Jesus. But he says, I haven't found anything guilty in this man. I find no guilt or anything worth listening to in your charges against him. So I'm going to punish him and release him. He's done nothing deserving death. But the crowd cry out. They won't have any bar of it, verse 18. They cry out loudly together, away with this man. Give us that other guy, Barabbas, the murderer, the rebel. Pilate again can see this is the wrong choice to make, but they're insistent. They keep shouting, crucify him, crucify him. Urgent, loud, demanding cries that he be killed. So life is in Pilate's hands, and eventually Pilate gives in and just lets the crowd have what they want. He delivers Jesus over to their will, we're told in verse 25. They're uncertain times. It'd be a terrible time to live, to see this unfolding and to feel the tension of this moment. But Jesus actually points out there's going to be more uncertain times coming. As he's handed over to this crowd, they then drag him out of the city and people are crying and mourning. The women come in behind him and they're crying because of what's happened to Jesus. They know he's a good man. But Jesus says to them, don't weep for me, but weep for yourselves because there are worse days coming. And 30 years later, we see Jerusalem itself burned to the ground by the Roman Empire because Rome is just sick of them pushing back against them. Really uncertain times. But in the midst of this uncertainty, there are a couple of men who face an even deeper uncertainty. In verse 32, we see there's two other people alongside Jesus who are dragged outside the city. Two others were criminals, were led away to be put to death with him. In some ways, these two men are facing a very obvious, certain future. their future is very clear. Soon they'll be nailed to this piece of wood and they will breathe out their last over the next day. Their future is certain, but I think they face that deeper uncertainty that we all feel as we see death on the horizon. They feel that deepest kind of uncertainty as they're about to face this kind of darkness, to head into this. It's a deeper kind of uncertainty that I think we can all appreciate. And that throughout the history of humanity, people have reflected on this, written poems about this. This is very famous lines, often quoted by Shakespeare, but they resonate with this shadowy dread sense of uncertainty that we have as we face death. Shakespeare quotes in Hamlet, he says, "Devoutly to be wished to die, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of." You know, surely death is the darkest uncertainty. Death is that thing that we dive into that we have no idea what it's like on the other side. And maybe if you've ever stood at a graveside, you have felt that sensation. It's hard not to feel those tendrils of doubt kind of creeping out over us as we see and are confronted with that moment that we all must face. But here is one man who stands confident in the face of it all. Jesus. Here's a confident king we're introduced to. So that's the charge that he's on trial for before this governor, is to say that he's a king. But look at him. He stands there confident as a king. They ask, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he says, "You have said so." And from that point on, he's questioned, he's tormented, he's abused, he's beaten, he's mocked. People scream at him for his death, but Jesus stands confident, staring death down. The claim of kinship that's brought him to the cusp of the grave is held over him, but he holds to it. He stands confidently as the king, interrogated again and again, but he stands calm and silent. They scream for his blood, but he's not swayed. An innocent man calmly stands in with the condemned. And even then, in verse 33, when we see Jesus actually being nailed to the cross and being lifted up, what does he say? He says at verse 34, Jesus, as he's there hanging on the cross, nails in his hands, he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." What kind of man is this? A confident king. Here's a man that we can look to and put our confidence in as well. Someone who, as he's breathing out his last breath, his thoughts are for those around him, for them to find forgiveness from God. And now the thief on the cross, he also is looking at this man. He's looking at the cross next door to Jesus, and he looks to Jesus, and there's a new kind of certainty that settles on his mind. He looks at Jesus, and even now, ironically, he thinks he really is the king. There they are, all hanging on the cross, the pictures painted out for us in verse 39. And one of the criminals there on Jesus' side calls out to him and says, "Aren't you the Messiah? Why don't you save yourself? Save us." But this other guy who's just starting to see Jesus in a new light, he realizes something's going on. He says, "Don't you fear God? We are under this condemnation rightly because we have done the wrong thing. But you look at this man. He's done nothing wrong. The thief on the cross begins to see Jesus in a new light with certainty that actually he is the king. And that the reality of being forgiven by God or not does in fact hang in the hands of this man on the cross next to him. That he can legitimately cry out, forgive them, and it will happen. And he sees this man and he knows he's utterly innocent, not just in the eyes of the Roman Empire, but in the eyes of God. He's completely innocent. Now imagine what kind of a friend Jesus must have been. Always faithful, never going behind his friends' backs, never gossiping about them, always looking out for a way to pick you up or care for you. I mean, what an amazing leader Jesus must have been. Always doing what's right, specifically seeking out the people that have been marginalized and bringing them back into society in the center. What kind of a person he must have been. Not like me. Not like me, says the guy on the cross as well. Next door, he looks and he says, that's not me. And at this point, I think a different kind of uncertainty begins to settle on this man's mind. A deep relational uncertainty between him and God. And he throws himself under the bus. He says, oh, I've done the wrong thing. We're rightly condemned for what we're doing, but not this man. He throws himself under the bus. He says, we're getting what we deserve. We've messed up our relationship with God big time. See how he pitches it in terms of God, not just the Roman Empire, but he says, don't you fear God? He knows that Rome can do nothing more to him now, but there is one who still looks over this and is to be answered. And he knows that his relationship has been messed up with God big time. See, this guy gets what sin is. You know, sin might be a kind of musty Christian word to you and never really thought about it before. But what sin is actually deep down under the surface is just is a relational rejection of God. We've got four kids and I love them dearly. And we brought them into this world. Right? We've given them everything that they have. We throw gifts on them at birthday times. We throw chocolate on them at Easter. We comfort them when they're sad and angry. We teach them what it looks like to grow up in this world. But imagine if they simply ignored me, or just gave me the cold shoulder, never looked me in the eye from morning to evening, never said hello, never said thank you, never said I love you, Dad. What if they said, I never needed you in the first place? I'm a self-made child. I've made me what I am. What if they pushed me further away? What if they said, why do you keep imposing your ideas on me? I'm my own family. Who even are you to me? Sin is this, but us towards God. It's a relational rejection of God, and we've all done some of this, and maybe all of it. And God's done so much more to us than I've ever done for my children. This guy on the cross, he's way past pretending that everything is okay between him and God. And I wonder if you might echo this man's words and say, I'm guilty. But here comes what is the biggest moment for this criminal on the cross. A moment of certain hope. This guy throws himself under the bus, and he is a self-confessed sinner, but he also throws his heart out to Jesus, and he says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And look at what Jesus says. Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. Paradise, right? A place of infinite peace, a place of immeasurable joy, a real place, a physical place, A place that's in the Bible described like a mighty banquet, a place that's described like a beautiful wedding. Jesus assures this broken man with all the same certainty that we've seen in Jesus so far to this point, that they will soon rejoice in paradise together. How could this be? It's because Jesus is acting out God's ultimate forgiveness. God's been pointing to this for thousands of years, pointing ahead to a person who will come and who will be God himself stepping into the uncertainty of our world and absorbing all of our relational rebellion that we've pushed towards God, absorbing all of our sin like a sponge until there is nothing left on us. And this guy on the cross, he's come to his darkest hour. He knows that he's a broken man. He knows that Jesus is not. And in fact, incredibly, he trusts that Jesus, even now, is the king over all and is about to sit down on his throne. And he does the only sensible thing in the world. He reaches out for Jesus. Now, this guy, he's got nothing to offer. He's dying on the cross. He can offer nothing. He simply cries out to Jesus to remember him. And in that one reply, Jesus is saying so much more. Saying, of course, this is why I came. I bring God's forgiveness. I take your guilt. I give you my innocence. And today, you'll be with me in paradise. And for the rest of that agonizing day for that criminal on the cross, he's overwhelmed not with pain, but with the knowledge that he is forgiven. Certain hope has grown up in him where he knows the innocence of Jesus is enough even for his deepest sin. A fountain of hope fills his soul with joy that soon he will be with Jesus in paradise. Do you know, this is what it looks like to be a Christian. A Christian is someone who's thrown themselves under the bus, recognizing our relational rejection of God, to know that we can't actually cut it when it comes to living a great life. A Christian is someone who recognizes that, and that runs deep, and that there's nothing we can actually do about it. But a Christian is someone who's seen that in themselves, but who's also seen Jesus. Seen his perfection, seen his innocence, seen his forgiveness, and has cried out to Jesus to remember them. They're someone who knows that God has truly said to us, I forgive you. Someone who trusts firmly in what Jesus has done, not what I've done. Someone who's filled with joy knowing that they will ever be with Jesus in paradise. That Sunday is coming, and that's a reality for us too. Now, these accounts of Jesus in the Bible that we have, they're not just informations for us, but they're invitations. It's not just information for us to read and absorb and be interested in this story, but an invitation. The Bible is inviting us to recognize ourselves in the shoes of this man on the cross, and to recognize that God has given everything to bring his children back, that he loves to forgive, and for us to taste and see that this is something that we can have too. I want to leave you with that invitation to think about this person, Jesus, and to put yourselves in this man's shoes. Have a look at one of those books on the table at the back and read through that account again and see if that's you. Is that yourself too? And maybe come along to the Taste and See series that we have to think about what this is all about a little bit more. The invitation to cry out to Jesus this Easter and find forgiveness and joy and a certain hope that we have in him. Let's pray together. Father, thank you so much for the certain hope that we have in Jesus, that as we see this story unfold, we can see that even in this darkest time, even with death on the line, we have something to hold to, and that Jesus, our sure and certain King, still is the King. And that we can cry out to him forgiveness and peace and know that we are his forever. Amen.